Today is February the 28th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program. However, WBAI is in a membership drive tonight and the personal computer show on WBAI has been preempted. But first, what do we have in the news? What is Android Go? With any Android phone, the basic cost is the hardware. The operating system Android is at no cost to the manufacturer, other than making sure that the hardware interfaces with the operating system and all functions are working properly. Android Go is a modified version of Android to enable manufacturers to lower the cost of hardware to run the Android operating system. Google's target goal is to be able to run on cell phones that cost under $50. Hey, that's very ambitious. There's a big global market out there projected to be about 500 million people where the price point to purchase a cell phone is $30. That means redesigning Android to more efficiently use less memory and less storage. It's a very ambitious program for Google. A lightweight version of Android optimized for entry-level devices. Google has tried its hand at the budget segment previously with the Android One initiative, but Android Go is really redesigning from the ground up for a budget segment of the population. Android Go isn't that different from the regular Android. Android Go uses the same foundation as a standard version of Android, but with several stability and performance tweaks thrown in to ensure that it works on devices with underpower hardware. The first version of Android Go is built on Android 8.1 Oreo, and the operating system also has data management features integrated at a system-wide level, giving it the ability to closely monitor data storage. Like all devices as certified by Google, Android Go phones will come with Google Play Protect out of the box. The security suite leverages machine learning to look for malicious apps on your phone. It also constantly scans the installed apps, even those that haven't been downloaded from the Play Store, to ensure that your device is secure. The platform comes with its own suite of apps. Android Go is designed primarily to run on phones with less than 1 gigabyte of RAM. Google has rolled out lightweight versions of all its apps tailored to the platform. Designed from the ground up, Google Go gives you the ability to query the web and find recommendations, delivering a similar experience as the full-fledged Google app for a fraction of the install size. The lightweight keyboard retains the same feature set as the standard version: autocorrect, voice typing, multilingual language support, emojis, and GIFs, but in a smaller package. A new storage manager removing old files and cleaning the device cache, and also comes with a feature that lets you easily send and receive files. There's also YouTube Go, which was previously a beta launch in more than 130 countries. You can use the app for watching all your favorite YouTube clips, and Google even lets users download videos for use offline in basic, standard, and high-quality resolution. Better yet, these videos can be shared with other users without any sort of data connection. The lightweight apps combined with fewer pre-installed apps means you get double the amount of storage on a phone with 8 gigabytes of internal storage when seen against the standard version of Android. The Play Store on Android Go devices will highlight lightweight apps that are designed to work best on the platform. To make this work, there has to be additional hardware, and both Qualcomm and MediaTek have announced support for the Android Go platform. Qualcomm has mentioned that low and mid-tier Snapdragon chipsets will be powering Android Go phones. With Android Go, Google is aiming to show that it's possible to deliver a decent sub-$50 device by optimizing the software to run effectively on low-power hardware and introducing lightweight versions of popular apps. Google is finally on track to provide a cost-effective solution for those looking to make a switch to lower-cost devices. I wouldn't be surprised if Android Go becomes a de facto Android operating system on the marketplace. Android Go is slated for delivery in the first half of this year. Apple has always been the higher priced item. However, if the margin of price difference is that great, it will put pressure on Apple to rethink their product line. There is Windows 10 and there is Windows 10. There were essentially 6 distribution versions of Windows 7, totaling 13 variations. Without going into the details of it, there was Windows 7 Starter, Windows 7 Home Basic, Windows 7 Home Premium, Windows 7 Professional, Windows 7 Enterprise, and Windows 7 Ultimate. And there were the European and Korean versions with variations on that. Well, when it came to upgrading to Windows 10, this obviously contributed to much confusion. Not to be outdone by Windows 7, there are now 12 distributions of Windows 10. Windows 10 has 12 editions and all its other variants. Windows 10 Home, Windows 10 Pro, Windows 10 Enterprise, Windows 10 Education, Windows 10 Pro Education, Windows 10 Enterprise Long-Term Support, Windows 10's Mobile Enterprise, Mobile 10 Mobile. By the way, in the case of the Mobile Enterprise and Mobile, that's actually ARM architecture. Then there's Windows 10 Internet of Things, Windows 10 S, Windows 10 Team, and Windows 10 Pro for workstations. Well, it's a mouthful. So what else is new with Microsoft as to the different versions of the operating system? Now there's a new wrinkle. Some of the editions are changeling, as I call them, as installed by the manufacturers. The most notable one is Windows 10 S. Windows 10 S is a specific configuration of Windows 10 Pro that offers a familiar, productive Windows experience that's streamlined for security and performance. Those are their words. And by exclusively using apps in the Microsoft Store, ensuring that you browse safely with all the other parts of the operating system running fast and secure, well, how does Windows 10 S compare to Windows 10 Home and Windows 10 Pro? Windows 10 S is a specific configuration of Windows 10 Pro, but it's been cut back to maintain security and performance. It exclusively runs apps from the Microsoft Store and uses Microsoft Edge as its default browser. Windows 10 S was inspired by, as they claim, by students and teachers for schools. It's also a great choice for any Windows customer looking for consistent performance and advanced security. But, and that's a big but, by limiting apps to those only from the Microsoft Store, there might be applications that you want that just won't run. Windows 10 S is ideal for people who have everything they need strictly from the Microsoft Store, and they just want the peace of mind that comes with removing the risk of downloading apps from other places. In other words, you're restricted from downloading and running anything that is not from the Microsoft Store. You can switch to Windows 10 Pro easily at any time, though, through the Microsoft Store in Windows for an affordable price. In other words, you can switch Windows 10 Pro easily at any time through the Microsoft Store and in Windows for an affordable price. Payment is collected, though, through the Microsoft Store. Switching to Pro is one way. If you make the switch, you won't be able to go back to Windows 10 S. The net of all this is that manufacturers can offer a lower price system with Windows 10 S, which is a subset of Windows 10 Pro. What I'm concerned with is beware of the verbiage in the ads for these low-cost systems when they say it's Windows 10 Pro capable. That doesn't mean it's installed with Windows 10 Pro, it's just that it's capable. In other words, you can upgrade Windows 10 S to Windows 10 Pro. Windows 10 S is not available at retail at all. Windows 10 S is not a retail product. Microsoft says it would cost $49 or less to upgrade to Windows 10 Pro. That means it depends on how much you paid for the system. The exception is a temporary offer for consumer devices priced at $799 or higher, where the switch to Windows 10 Pro would be both free of charge and include a free Office 365 personal subscription. Dr. Alfred Poor with Wearable and Health Technologies. Wearables to help diabetes patients. electrical brain stimulation can aid memory, and bionic retina implant cleared for clinical trials.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
As I've been saying for quite some time, the fitness band market is going to have to pivot and become more focused on health and medical applications if it's going to survive. Now, we've seen a lot of evidence of this so far, and here's another story that just adds more evidence to this whole change in the marketplace. Diabetes is a major problem, not just in this country, but worldwide. It costs billions of dollars a year in healthcare costs. For people who develop type 2 diabetes, it turns out that exercise and diet and other kinds of activities can help reduce the disease and in some cases have made it possible for people to go off medication altogether. A recent announcement by United Healthcare is that they are partnering with two wearable companies, Dexcom, which makes continuous glucose monitors. These are wearables that monitor your blood glucose level 24/7 around the clock rather than having to do occasional finger sticks. And the other partner is Fitbit, the fitness band company. This new program is for certain Medicare Advantage patients who have diabetes, type 2 diabetes, in a United Healthcare program. And this pilot program is going to give them the constant glucose monitor, the CGM, made by Dexcom. And they're also going to get a fitness tracker from Fitbit. And the idea is that by providing more information and being able to track the patient's biometric data, the glucose levels, activity levels, heart rate, and other kinds of information, it's going to be possible to help manage their disease better and hopefully lower some of the costs of the disease and eliminate some of the costly complications that can arise. So it's another example of how wearables are changing healthcare, making it more proactive rather than reactive. And this has a possibility to save lives, improve quality of life, and save a lot of money in the process. I had a really good story lined up for this next segment, but I forget what it is. No, actually, I remember. But if you're like me, you've reached a certain age where remembering things becomes a bit more of a challenge. And in fact, one of the things that throughout our lives, it's difficult sometimes to learn some things, and some people have a harder time learning things than others. Maybe there are just some facts that won't stick in your brain, maybe like your wedding anniversary date or something like that. But there's some recent studies that was published by researchers who discovered that by directly stimulating the brain with electrical current, they can help a subject remember a given fact more reliably. This study used a small number of subjects. They were epilepsy patients who already had electrodes implanted in their brains for other purposes. And so what they were able to discover was that by giving an electrical stimulation at the time that the patient was trying to learn a new word or a new fact, it could help them remember it better. The interesting thing is they discovered that there were two kinds of memory. There were some facts that people didn't have trouble learning. They were learning them well. And then there are other ones they could see by the brain patterns that they were having a more difficult time learning that new fact. As it turns out, the electrical stimulation doesn't help all the time. Only when it appears that the brain is going to have difficulty remembering the new fact does the electrical stimulation help. If you use electrical stimulation all the time while the person's trying to learn something new, it doesn't help. It actually hinders learning things that the brain was going to remember pretty easily anyway. So it's a way of giving a little jolt for the things that are going to be weakly remembered to make it a stronger memory. So it's an interesting development. Not quite sure what the practical application is going to be at this point. Hopefully we won't have school students running around with electrodes in their heads trying to remember things better. But it does point towards some interesting developments in learning how memory happens, and perhaps there will be ways that this technology can be used to help people learn better. Macular degeneration is a disease of the eye in which the light-sensitive cells in the back of the eyeball degenerate and the person loses vision and in the center of their field of vision and eventually goes blind. The fact is that their nerve cells at the back of the eye are still functional. It's just there's nothing there to convert the light into stimulus that will then travel through the optic nerve to the brain. A company called Pixium Vision has just received clearance for clinical trials for a new implant that goes behind the retina and sits directly on the nerve cells in the back of the eye. The way it works is a tiny camera mounted on a pair of glasses sends image data to a small computer processor, which then sends the images back to a small projector mounted in the glasses that projects the image into the eye. The implant then captures this light image from the projector and converts that into electrical impulses, which stimulate the patient's nerves in the back of their eyeball, which goes to the optic nerve and can be perceived as an image. The interesting thing about this approach is that it's wireless. There's no contacts or electrodes going into the eyeball to send the signal. It's done with the tiny projector to send the image instead. Hopefully, we'll be able to restore the vision for patients who have lost it due to macular degeneration or other similar problems.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Where are we today with home 3D printer units? 3D printing is not as new as you may think. Stratasys founder Scott Crump invented in 1989 FDMM technology, which stands for Fused Deposition Modeling. When the FDM patents expired, 3D printing became such a hot topic that it was easy to believe it was a brand new innovation. And because it gained such a wide media coverage, people often imagined that FDM was the only manufacturing technique. In reality, the first 3D printing technique was SLA, not FDM, and its first patent was 1986, called SLA, which stands for stereolithography. The patent was issued to Chuck Hull. In 2009, MakerBot, located in Brooklyn, took some of the open source foundation projects and created their own 3D printer kit for sale. Since the company's humble beginnings, the company has sold over 100,000 3D printers. MakerBot is significant, and because it is one of the most visible companies at the forefront of 3D printing. Suddenly, excitement and speculation grew around the growing affordability of 3D printing, giving many hobbyists, professionals, and makers the ability to make what MakerBot claims as almost anything. MakerBot also created Thingiverse, or Thingiverse, or however you want to pronounce it, Thingiverse, which is an online file library from which you can download 3D printable files or submit your own designs for download. The company MakerBot was acquired by Stratasys in 2013 for about $400 million. There were three factors that impeded the marketing of 3D printers. The print process of creating 3D objects was measured in minutes to hours. This is a very long process. The consumer 3D printers were limited in the physical size of the created object. I jokingly call them chess pieces. But in reality, if you have the patience, you can build a larger object by integrating the created smaller pieces into a larger unit. Finally, there was a relatively high cost, and it was into the thousands for a 3D printer. Since newer models were routinely introduced each month by many manufacturers, the excitement for 3D printing faded into the background. So where are we today with 3D printing? HP has industrial 3D printers about the size of two washing machines. The HP Jet Fusion printer line has a starting price of about $130,000 going up to or under $250,000. These printers, however, can create much larger objects and is 10 times faster at the minimum in the print process. The price point, however, is not intended for the consumer market. So, what is available for the consumer market? There are two notable units on the market today. There is the XYZ Printing DaVinci Mini 3D printer that sells for slightly above $200, and the monoprice MP Select Mini 3D printer version 2, selling for also slightly above $200, although it's on sale now for $180 and or even less. For hobbyists or those who are interested in robotics, these units are very affordable. But the print speed and the limitation on physical size has not changed. The maximum size print object, and that's what I call them, for the DaVinci printer is 5.9 inch cube. In other words, 5.9 by 5.9 by 5.9. And the maximum size print object for the monoprice is 4.72 inches cube. Well, when might we see every home would have a 3D printer? It is affordable, but the print speed hasn't reawakened consumer interest. But at least many homes can now afford to have one. 3D printing technology is exciting, but it is a product in search of a mainstream consumer need to have one in the home. These units only provide a very small amount of initial supplies to get you started. So if you do want to buy one of these units, plan on ordering more supplies. And they cost about $20 for a row of the filament that's needed. How long would it last? Depends on the object you have. You should always factor in the cost of the consumables. I predict that one day, hopefully in the near future, the printer itself, like the typical color printers that we have, which are inkjet printers, are really at almost giveaway prices, and it's the consumables that's what they're selling. Bottom line, if you're looking for a starter 3D printer or a chance to dip your toe into the 3D waters without spending a lot, these units may give you an excuse to have one in the home. Marty Winston and I were reminiscing about what computers were like back in the, well, long time ago, 50, 60 years ago. And I had mentioned to him that one of the machines I worked on was a TTL, or transistor logic machine, that was originally developed by Raytheon and Honeywell. At that time, Honeywell was a computer company, and it was called an H800 mainframe system. One of the engineers looked at the circuit and said, you know what, I can generate sound from that circuit. So he wrote a little program that played a tune, selecting different parts of the circuit to come up with a tune. And it was a clarinet polka. It sounded pretty good. So I asked him, what was the purpose of coming up with it? And the company went ahead and even installed a Altec Lansing speaker, 8-inch speaker system, into the mainframe itself. He says, well, it actually gives us a quick way of diagnosing a problem with the hardware. When you hear a sour note, we know what part of the circuit to look at. That's quite fascinating. So I said to Marty, that's an interesting topic. He says, hey, do you know how it's done? And to be honest, I really didn't know how. And now he's going to explain the technical parts of it, which I'm still scratching my head.
Hey, can I take your pulse? Our cybernetic house project has thousands of places where we have to ingest analog information into a digital system, sensor readings, for example. In electronics, there's a pulse where digital and analog meet. In fact, a whole series of binary pulses, some wider than others. Binary values, you know, are either one or zero, either on or off, either at a higher voltage or a lower one, with absolutely nothing in between. It's on or it's off, that's it. Analog values aren't at all locked to those limits. They can be all over the place. An analog signal is constantly changing its energy profile over time. So one of the few things a digital system can do to parallel that is to change the width, meaning duration, of pulses in a series. The official term for that, and that's what today's all about, is pulse width modulation, or PWM. It's also sometimes called, not so much anymore, but it's sometimes called pulse duration modulation, because it's really the duration of the pulse, the width of the pulse as you look at it, that's varying. Pulse width modulation is how most contemporary, think about this, lighting dimmers work. The wider the pulse within its clock, the longer its duty cycle, so the more light comes off, make the pulse narrower, there's less energy, comes down, dims, lighting dimmers. Same thing if you've got a variable speed power tool. The harder you squeeze the trigger, the faster it goes. Pulse width modulation to the motor. So imagine it's 60 years ago, and you're a telephone company shuttling millions and millions of analog signals around everywhere. Computing back then is not brand new, but they were nowhere near as fast or powerful as ours. Could a digital computer sound like a human voice? In 1961, programmers at Bell Labs got a ballroom-size IBM 7094 to output this.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to... I'm crazy all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The IBM 7094 sang Daisy Bell, also known as Daisy Daisy or Bicycle Built for Two. It was a strictly binary computer with a clock pulse. You might want to take notes in case you want to build yourself a warehouse-sized computer. A clock, well, not warehouse-sized, really ballroom-sized. Clock pulse width was 2 microseconds. A look at the waveform, if you could see it, shows 6 clusters of sound every 0.05 seconds, every 20th of a second, and 7 specific kind of molecular sound events, each 0.01, 100th of a second, each of those at one of a limited number of levels. Digital electronics only offers 2 output levels, high and low, some voltage and no voltage. In classic digital to analog conversion, the value of an entire 8-bit or longer data byte gets translated into corresponding voltage values. Using discrete components like transistors, this often means charging a capacitor more or less rapidly by scaling a cluster of current sources that were respectively each double the next. That's a little bit of what happens in digital to analog converters, and it's a little bit of the trick they did in 1961. You can download it, look at the waveform yourself. In modern electronics, that serial conversion of parallel data has largely given away to variants of pulse width modulation. For digital to analog, a serial conversion of serial data, you know, one at a time, in series, serial data, all the bits to make up the byte come like pearls on a necklace. So serial data in which the length of time that pulse values remain high, following this, so we've got a series of pulses and their duration, the amount of time they remain high, gets interpreted into an analog value. It's how much energy is in the pulse. That's the analog value that the pulse duration is communicating. So the percentage of on time to total pulse duration is something very important for slower things like speed control and dimming. That's called its duty cycle. Now, there may be slow changes, as with PWM control of things like the examples I mentioned, light dimming, power tool, variable speed motor controls. There may be slightly faster changes, 60, 120 times a second, like in digital switching power supplies, or faster still, like in Class D audio amplifiers, highly efficient because they've moved audio into a pulse train, treated the pulse train, and then output it as audio. The analogs, or RF, by the way, it's not all in the audio range. The analog signal that derives from pulse width modulated sources still has that, like teeth on a comb, that comb tooth texture that results from the pulsed source. So there is generally some filtering to reject the higher frequencies of the pulses and pass the lower frequencies of the analog signal. Raspberry Pi, our favorite little deck-a-card-sized computer, the Raspberry Pi audio jack doesn't output true analog. It outputs PWM. If you want to amplify that, you could, for example, this is pretty simple, put a 1K resistor between the jack's output and the amplifier's input, and a 0.01 microfarad capacitor from that amplifier input to ground. You get a simple RC low-pass filter with a corner frequency of around 16 kilohertz. In a way, this is a little bit like traditional radio, where there's a higher frequency carrier carrying lower frequency modulation. The carrier on FM is in megahertz, but my voice isn't. And that's more or less how remote controls work. The infrared remote controls for consumer products are not at all analog. They do showcase some interesting attributes of pulse duration signaling. The data carrying serial pulse trains in remote controls have pulses that are either short, representing 0, or long, representing 1. This is the data that sends command codes to equipment, TV sets or VCRs or whatever. DVRs. Make that DVRs. Take a deeper look. These pulses are actually not pulses. These pulses are actually envelopes of carrier, higher frequency pulses. Several carrier frequencies are in use among the various remote control manufacturers. It's one way of preventing functional overlap among different remotes. By the way, pulsing the carrier also helps infrared emitters handle higher power levels because it gets to cool down when the pulse is off. And it also, same time, same reason, helps extend battery runtime. Now, I learned all that when I read up on remote controls while figuring out how our ceiling pods in the cybernetic house could get the volume on a TV set to slowly fade and then turn the TV off if you happen to doze off while watching. My ceiling pod won't doze off. You know why? It's because I back up. And so should you. Hank?
Thank you, Marty. New and improved Windows RT. Whenever you hear about a new and improved product, you want to know how was it improved. New and improved could just be rebranding. How many remember Coke and Coke Classic? New and improved could be a reformulation of the product. New and improved could mean, well, just a change in some features or price. New and improved Windows RT may not exist on paper, but Microsoft basically introduced it as a new and improved Windows RT. Is it rebranding? Yes. They now call it Windows 10 Mobile. A short time ago, it had referred to this OS as Windows 10 ARM. Obviously, if Windows RT had been successful, the RT designation would have been retained. Where did Windows RT fail? Calling the operating system Windows inferred it would run existing Windows applications. It turned out all the applications need to be recompiled to reference the ARM instruction set and architecture. Can we now assume Windows 10 Mobile will run Windows applications? Microsoft says, well-behaved programs written according to Microsoft guidelines should run. That is a joke, as some of Microsoft's applications may not adhere to the definition of being well-behaved. The hardware instruction of Intel-based system is not the same as the hardware instruction for RISC system. Microsoft says Windows Intel-based applications will run on the RISC system via emulation. What is emulation? Emulation is the process of mimicking the outwardly observable behavior to match an existing target. The internal state of the emulation mechanism does not have to accurately reflect the internal state of the target which it is emulating. You might have heard the term simulation. What is it and how does it differ with emulation? Simulator mimics the activity to be the same as the thing being simulated. Simulation, on the other hand, involves modeling the underlying state of the target, and the end result of a good simulation is that the simulation model would emulate the target which it is simulating. Some internal aspects of the simulation may actually be an emulation. Whether it's an emulation simulation, the application will almost always run more than one instruction for each instruction in the Windows Intel-based application. This means you can expect applications running on Windows 10 Mobile will take longer to run compared to the same functional application running on the Windows 10 Intel-based system. If the publisher recompiles the application to run native RISC code, then the application should execute at optimum speed. A well-behaved program should interface with the peripherals of the new drivers readily available for the external device. This may or may not be available, however, and with a regular Windows OS, software drivers for legacy hardware can be installed in compatibility mode. This does not exist with Windows 10 Mobile. A comparable Windows 10 Mobile unit is about the same price as for a Windows 10 Intel-based OS. Does Windows 10 Mobile operating system have any advantages over what I would now call Windows 10 Classic? Yeah, there's one major feature in Windows 10 Mobile that it's claimed to be able to stay on for 30 hours. Well, how do they get 30 hours? This is normally based on an idle system with a screen at the dimmest level. I generally divide the quoted battery lifetime by 2. Still, 15 hours is impressive. But how often can you say you need to work a 15-hour day with no access to be able to recharge the battery? Windows 10 Mobile is new and improved, but I don't think it's cost-effective nor efficient, at least not for me. We are going to wrap up that interview that we had last week with Dr. Nick Van Terhaden. It was quite fascinating, and if you missed that first half, you can hear it on a podcast from last week. The podcast is available at prn.fm as well as wbai.org/archive and from our website, pcradioshow.org. Well, I'm sure you have some commentary about the flu shots that we've been asked to take this season, and it has not been as effective that everyone had hoped it would be.
Yeah, so I think the flu shots, you know, that's a cyclical thing. We see different flu strains that get transmitted around the world. Flu season for us is in the winter months. In the southern hemisphere, it's the opposite. And what we try and do is learn from their experience, and we adapt. And the scientists do their best job at predicting, but they're not always accurate. In fact, most years they're not. And, you know, mostly it doesn't matter. The reality is, for most people, and, you know, obviously you need to take clinical advice in your own individual circumstances, but for the majority of people, taking the vaccine is the right thing to do. It protects you, even if it's not full protection, even if it's not going to protect, if you don't receive the vaccine for that strain, it will improve your immune response and reduce the overall impact of that flu if you happen to be unlucky enough to be exposed to it. So the science is very clear. It is not surprising that they don't get it right. It's an impossible task. It's like predicting hurricanes. You know, look at the tracks. That's the same principle of flu. We do our best, but sometimes we don't get it exactly right. But the reality is having a hurricane warning and saying, hey, you need to get out just in case, even if we got it wrong, is the right call because that saves lives. And that's true for the flu vaccine as well. It saves lives.
You know, one of the areas that I feel, and when you talk about medicine, that is perhaps somewhat overlooked is mental health, because much of the homelessness we have is really people who are mentally ill and they're out in the streets.
Yeah, so I again, another area of strong feelings for me. I grew up in a profession that it treated itself very poorly when it came to what you call mental health. I have a sense that that term doesn't help because it tends to sort of stigmatize, and I talk about brain health. It's a disease. It's a disease that we have real trouble sort of comprehending as human beings because you can't see it, you can't feel it. And it's interesting that we end up apologizing, you know, for anything associated with mental health. But I would never apologize for having cancer, for instance. And yet they're very similar. They're diseases. We don't, you know, fully understand cancer, but we can wrap our sort of mind around it. I've seen friends commit suicide. I think it is an enormously challenging problem. And our ability to respect and openly talk about it and accept this as a disease, something that is treatable, something that needs to be addressed, is an imperative. And you're right. The majority of our sort of care process, and I've seen this in other countries, not just this one, where we sort of essentially push that community into a circumstance that is, you know, essentially based on, you know, the social determinants of health, and they're so poorly impacted that, as you rightly say, they end up on the street. They're homeless, which of course is the worst possible place to manage or treat or care for that. And then that becomes an association. All homeless people have mental health problems or brain disease. And that's truly not the case, but that's essentially what we're sort of driving. And it is such an important area to sort of focus and be open and honest. Yet people struggle with that because if I turn around and say, I have a brain disorder, you know, there's a tendency to label somebody, and, you know, it creates all these challenges. So you're right to sort of highlight that and pick on it. I'd love to see technology helping. I know I had some friends working in some of these areas where, you know, potentially focusing on both the diagnosis. One of the interesting things is we can actually start to diagnose and understand clinical disorders based on voice. You know, you can determine, I can listen to you over the phone and I can pick up if you're, you know, happy, sad, not maybe as accurately, but I think we're starting to see some capacity. And is there some potential to start some monitoring and offer some, you know, guidance and support, not in a big brother, you know, punitive way, but in a supportive way that says, hey, there's a problem. We need to address this. So I think there's some potential for technology to help, but you're right to highlight it. And it's an area of, you know, desperate need at this point.
Biggest challenge we have is when we try to put them back into their neighborhood, the people don't want them there. In fact, they disown right. them. They say, we don't know them. We're not related to them. It's cultural.
It's a dreadful, dreadful tragedy. You know, and what we've seem to have done in some instances is turn our jail system into a care, and I use inverted commas around that, for people with brain disorders. And, you know, acceptance is, you know, of people that are different or their brains work differently. One of the things that I really like, if you're not familiar, the series The Good Doctor, which was actually imported from, I believe, from Korea originally, sort of tackles this in an unusual way with an autistic individual who actually qualifies and becomes a doctor. And I think they do a really fascinating job of showing him both in this awkward circumstance of how he interacts, the difficulties of the social interaction, but the value that he brings in terms of a different insight, different way of seeing things. He essentially has a different lens. It's like he puts on a pair of glasses and sees things differently. And I think that's true for mental health and our, you know, challenges to rise above that. And, you know, I've got to be honest, I think technology and particularly social media and, you know, some of the isolation that drives, I think doesn't help. It sort of creates this method of sort of separating us and puts us in an echo chamber where we look for people that are like us, when in fact the real value is people that are different bring so much, you know, growth and potential for learning. And that's one of the privileges that I've had of living around the world and interacting with different countries. I was born in Africa and, you know, my heart still remains there. And I feel this passion for learning and exposing to other cultures, people, individuals. And I hope that others can, you know, gain that same optimism and opportunity, you know, rather than looking at it and saying, I don't want to be involved with that.
When it comes to healthcare, does the medical industry also address the issue of treating them from a mental point of view on how the attitude is and how, well, it's a spirit, it's a human spirit. Is that ever factored into it?
I think we try. So let me start by saying I think every healthcare service provider, every clinician that is offering clinical care, and I use that in the broadest sense, everything from physicians through nurses, physiotherapists, you name it. I think they all walk into work every day trying desperately to deliver the best possible care and be humanistic about it. And that includes caring about the brain health, the what I would call the social determinants of health, all those other things. The reality is that the system and, you know, the environment that we're in actually challenges people in doing so. And what we've done is we've turned it into this production process where people are measured on time, you know, the value of that talking, the interaction that I have with these patients that need my care and understanding has been driven out. So I think people intend to get to that as much as possible. The challenge is that the system needs to change. And you reference this with the government, but that's one of the things that we really need to do is to help the regulatory system look at the whole person. You talked about China. Let me pick on them for, you know, hundreds of years ago. Their methodology was the village would all pay the doctor the time that they were healthy. But when they fell ill, they stopped paying the doctor. It's a very simplistic form of saying, I'm going to focus on wellness versus fee-for-service and just treating people as people and conditions. And I think we need to move more to the sort of whole body, whole person to get that point and to allow people to deliver the care that they desperately want to.
I have a question for you, though. When we talk about medicine, do you believe in the power of prayer?
I think prayer is presented or delivers value in our ability to control the mind. I think the mind has incredible potential to offer healing powers, to control pain. We see that manifested in lots of different ways, both in, you know, terms of meditation, in prayer, and even in the sort of the inducement through what I would call the placebo effect. And I don't mean that to diminish religion in any way. I'm trying to explain it scientifically. I think there's a basis for it, but it's just one that we don't understand. But absolutely, I saw it in my own parents, and I see it in friends. I think it's, you know, an extraordinarily important area of our lives. Yeah. Again, I think the capacity of the brain to adapt to circumstances and our ability to help and induce that through, you know, all the means that people find in their lives, I think is absolutely, it's an incredibly powerful tool.
Well, let me ask this from a different point of view. If you had the ability to control government, what would you change or what would you do that would make the healthcare in the United States more efficient and at lower cost?
Well, so, that's a difficult
question. That's a loaded question, I know.
it really is. It's a difficult question because, there's obviously multiple camps. There are folks that sort of look at single service or single provider, unified system, free, in inverted commas, at the point of care, like the NHS or, you know, some variation or maybe the Swiss system. And, you know, the reality is you have to accept, and this is part of the reason for, you know, my focus on incremental improvements. I don't think you can ignore where we are. So the idea that even if you thought it was right that we should have a single payer system, I think that's an unattainable goal, certainly in the short term. So we have to find methods of stepping through to get to the point of, you know, where we're delivering better value. An awful lot of that is aligning people's incentives appropriately with what we want in terms of outcomes. And when we essentially pay people to do things, then that's what they did. They did things. We need to pay for people to be healthy. So we need a wellness, a well-care system, not a healthcare system. And I think aligning the goals appropriately. As a final sort of pitch, I would say you can't do that in this country without addressing the issue of medical training and the cost of medical training. Part of what drives much of the physician reimbursement and the need for sort of compensation is to pay off these incredibly expensive loans that they take on to go through medical school. You can't ask for those folks to go through that process and then say, well, we can't compensate you at this level, because then they end up encumbered with this debt that precludes them from participating in society fairly. So you've got to take everything and deal with it and deal with the unintended consequences. So we could say, you know, nationalize the system and make all physicians salaried and lower the salary, but that doesn't address the medical education amongst a whole slew of other things. And so I don't think those are the answers. I think we have to find those small improvements that put us on the course to better healthcare that is driven by wellness, not on, you know, doing procedures or activities.
Do you ever get any pushback or disagreements from your colleagues on your views?
All the time.
All the time.
I'm happy to. Oh, absolutely. I'd love to believe I held the lock on being correct about everything, but I'm, you know, much more circumspect about it. I try desperately hard to put myself into the shoes of somebody that is does not have the same view as me. I try very hard to be outside of the echo chamber as much as possible. You know, the vaccine example is a great example of that. The idea that I sit there and say, you must have a vaccine, as an example where some of my colleagues might have that view, I just don't think works. I think we have to put ourselves into those perspectives. And there are plenty of disagreements, I think, you know, and much of this is about compromise. And we seem to have lost our capacity to compromise about things. And I think that's a key element. And, you know, that's part of medicine. We compromise all the time when we treat patients. There is no single answer all the time, especially when it gets to complex diseases and cancers, you know, and navigating that together as a team is the key facet to being successful in my mind.
Looking forward to March the 17th, and although that's St. Paddy's Day, you're going to be the keynote speaker at the Trenton Computer Festival, and this is the very topic. I don't know if you're going to be able to cover all this ground that we just covered or what some of the highlights you're going to be talking about.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited. You know, longstanding community and conference, real privilege to be invited and have that opportunity to present. I think, you know, healthcare is personal, and our ability to sort of help guide people through that personal journey, you know, hopefully inspire people as to how they might contribute, how they might engage. I'm looking forward to sharing some of that aspirational opportunity and also sharing some of those small improvements and some of the things that we've done. And I hope that, you know, some people will walk out of there with a renewed vigor of how I can be involved potentially in healthcare and how I might contribute to moving that needle towards, you know, fantastic care, widely distributed at low cost.
I'm looking forward to seeing you. And is there anything you want to ask me to be aware of for March the 17th?
No, I'm looking forward to it. I'm very excited to be joining you.
If you have any logistic issues, just send me an email or call me, and I'll take care of it before you come up.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Hank.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Public service announcements of local computer clubs in the Northeast Tri-State region. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on different categories of artificial intelligence. Thursday, March the 1st, 2018. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on iWork presented by the Apple Store on Friday, March the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916, that's 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on infographics with Power BI on Tuesday, March the 6th, 7:30 p.m., and they'll meet at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, March the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. NYU Silver Building, located in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, March the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the New York Institute of Technology on Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane in the auditorium of Harry J. Schur Hall. TCF is March the 17th, Saturday. It is a computer festival featuring talks, workshops, and vendors. The theme of the festival this year is wearable technologies. It will be held at the College of New Jersey from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, the website is tcf-nj.org. The keynote speaker is Dr. Nick Van Terheden. Dr. Nick is a leader in digital healthcare and in innovation and former chief medical officer for Dell. The feature speaker is George Harris with a presentation on medical tricorders, taking science fiction into reality. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, on prn.fm on the internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio, or wbai.org, streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup is very essential, so just back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.